Yahoo, who hastily lowered his eyes. They had already seen children die. For many months now, death had shown no favoritism, but they had never yet watched a child's agony minute by minute, as they'd now been doing since daybreak. Needless to say, the pain inflicted on these innocent victims had always seemed to them to be what in fact it was, an abominable thing. But hitherto they'd felt its abomination in, so to speak, an abstract way. They had never had to witness over so long a period the death throes of an innocent child. And just then the boy had a sudden spasm, as if something had bitten him in the stomach, and uttered a long, shrill wail. For moments that seemed endless, he stayed in a queer, contorted position, his body racked by convulsive tremors. It was as if his frail frame were bending before the fierce breath of the plague, breaking under the reiterated gusts of fever. Then the storm wind passed, there came a lull, and he relaxed a little. The fever seemed to recede, leaving him gasping for breath on a dank, pestilential shore, lost in a languor that already looked like death. When for the third time the fiery wave broke on him, lifting him a little, the child curled himself up and shrank away to the edge of the bed, as if in terror of the flames advancing on him, licking his limbs. A moment later, after tossing his head wildly to and fro, he flung off the blanket. From between the inflamed eyelids, big tears welled up and trickled down the sunken, leaden-hued cheeks. When the spasm had passed, utterly exhausted, tensing his thin legs and arms, on which, within 48 hours, the flesh had wasted to the bone, the child lay flat, racked on the tumbled bed in a grotesque parody of crucifixion. Bending, Tahu gently stroked with his big paw the small face stained with tears and sweat. Castel had closed his book a few moments before, and his eyes were now fixed on the child. He began to speak, but had to give a cough before continuing, because his voice rang out so harshly. There wasn't any remission this morning, was there, Rieux? Rieux shook his head, adding, however, that the child was putting up more resistance than one would have expected. Fan Lu, who was slumped against the wall, said in a low voice, "So, if he is to die, he will have suffered longer." Light was increasing in the ward. The occupants of the other 9 beds were tossing about and groaning, but in tones that seemed deliberately subdued. Only one at the far end of the ward was screaming, or rather uttering little exclamations at regular intervals, which seemed to convey surprise more than pain. Indeed, one had the impression that even for the sufferers, the frantic terror of the early phase had passed, and there was a sort of mournful resignation in their present attitude toward the disease. Only the child went on fighting with all his little might. Now and then Rieux took his pulse, less because they served any purpose than as an escape from his utter helplessness, and when he closed his eyes, he seemed to feel its tumult mingling with the fever of his own blood. And then, at one with the tortured child, he struggled to sustain him with all the remaining strength of his own body. But, linked for a few moments, the rhythms of their heartbeat soon fell apart, the child escaped him, and again he knew his impotence. Then he released the small, thin wrist and moved back to his place. The light on the whitewashed walls was changing from pink to yellow. The first waves of another day of heat were beating on the windows. They hardly heard Grand saying he would come back as he turned to go. All were waiting. The child, his eyes still closed, seemed to grow a little calmer. His claw-like fingers were feebly plucking at the sides of the bed. Then they rose, scratched at the blanket over his knees, and suddenly he doubled up his limbs, bringing his thighs above his stomach, and remained quite still. For the first time, he opened his eyes and gazed at Rieux, who was standing immediately in front of him. In the small face, rigid as a mask of grayish clay, slowly the lips parted, and from them rose a long, incessant scream, hardly varying with his respiration, and filling the ward with a fierce, indignant protest, so little childish that it seemed like a collective voice issuing from all the sufferers there. Rieux clenched his jaws. Tahu looked away. Rambert went and stood beside Castel, who closed the book, lying on his knees. Pandelou gazed down at the small mouth, fouled with the sorties of the plague, and pouring out the angry death cry that has sounded through the ages of mankind. He sank on his knees, and all present found it natural to hear him say in a voice hoarse but clearly audible across that nameless, never-ending wail, "My God, spare this child." But the wail continued without cease, and the other sufferers began to grow restless. The patient at the far end of the ward, whose little broken cries had gone out without a break, now quickened their tempo, so that they flowed together in one unbroken cry, while the other's groans grew louder. A gust of sobs swept through the room, drowning Panlu's prayer. And Rieu, who was still tightly gripping the rail of the bed, shut his eyes, dazed with exhaustion and disgust. When he opened them again, Tarou was at his side. "I must go," Rieu said. "I can't bear to hear them any longer." But then, suddenly, the other sufferers fell silent. And now the doctor grew aware that the child's wail, after weakening more and more, had fluttered out into silence. Around him the groans began again, but more faintly, like a far echo of the fight that now was over, for it was over. Castel had moved round to the other side of the bed and said the end had come. His mouth still gaping, but silent now, the child was lying among the tumbled blankets, a small shrunken form, with the tears still wet on his cheeks. Panlu went up to the bed and made the sign of benediction. Then, gathering up his cassock, he walked out by the passage between the beds. "Will you have to start it all over again?" Tarou asked Castel. The old doctor nodded slowly with a twisted smile. "Perhaps. After all, he put up a surprisingly long resistance." Rieu was already on his way out, walking so quickly and with such a strange look on his face that Panlu put out an arm to check him when he was about to pass him in the doorway. "Come, doctor," he began. Rieu swung round on him fiercely. "Ah, that child, anyhow, was innocent, and you know it as well as I do." He strode on, brushing past Panlu, and walked across the school playground. Sitting on a wooden bench under the dingy, stunted trees, he wiped off the sweat that was beginning to run into his eyes. He felt like shouting imprecations, anything, to loosen the stranglehold lashing his heart with steel. Heat was flooding down between the branches of the fig trees. A white haze, spreading rapidly over the blue of the morning sky, made the air yet more stifling. Rieu lay back wearily on the bench. Gazing at the ragged branches, the shimmering sky, he slowly got back his breath and fought down his fatigue. He heard a voice behind him. "Why was there that anger in your voice just now? What we'd been seeing was as unbearable to me as it was to you." Rieu turned toward Panlu. "I know. I'm sorry. But weariness is a kind of madness, and there are times when the only feeling I have is one of mad revolt." "I understand," Panlu said in a low voice. "That sort of thing is revolting because it passes our human understanding. But perhaps we should love what we cannot understand." Rieu straightened up slowly. He gazed at Panlu, summoning to his gaze all the strength and fervor he could muster against his weariness. Then he shook his head. "No, father. I have a very different idea of love, and until my dying day I shall refuse to love a scheme of things in which children are put to torture." A shade of disquietude crossed the priest's face. "Ah, doctor," he said sadly, "I have just realized what is meant by grace." Rieu had sunk back again on the bench. His lassitude had returned, and from its depths he spoke more gently. "It's something I haven't got, that I know, but I'd rather not discuss that with you. We're working side by side for something that unites us beyond blasphemy and prayers, and it's the only thing that matters." Panlu sat down beside Rieu. It was obvious that he was deeply moved. "Yes. Yes," he said, "you too are working for man's salvation." Rieu tried to smile. "Salvation's much too big a word for me. I don't aim so high. I'm concerned with man's health, and for me, his health comes first." Panlu seemed to hesitate. "Doctor," he began, then fell silent. Down his face, too, sweat was trickling. Murmuring goodbye for the present, he rose. His eyes were moist. When he turned to go, Rieu, who had seemed lost in thought, suddenly rose and took a step toward him. "Again, please forgive me. I can promise there won't be another outburst of that kind." Panlu held out his hand, saying regretfully, "And yet, I haven't convinced you. What does it matter? What I hate is death and disease, as you well know. And whether you wish it or not, we're allies, facing them and fighting them together." Rieu was still holding Panlu's hand. "So you see," but he refrained from meeting the priest's eyes, "God himself can't part us now." Since joining Rieu's band of workers, Panlu had spent his entire time in hospitals and places where he came in contact with plague. He had elected for the place among his fellow workers that he judged incumbent on him in the forefront of the fight. And constantly since then, he had rubbed shoulders with death. Though theoretically immunized by periodical inoculations, he was well aware that at any moment death might claim him too, and he had given thought to this. Outwardly, he had lost nothing of his serenity. But from the day on which he saw a child die, something seemed to change in him, and his face bore traces of the rising tension of his thoughts. When one day he told Rieu with a smile that he was working on a short essay entitled, "Is a Priest Justified in Consulting a Doctor?" Rieu had gathered that something graver lay behind the question than the priest's tone seemed to imply. On the doctor's saying he would greatly like to have a look at the essay, Vanloo informed him that he would be shortly preaching at a mass for men, and his sermon would convey some, at least, of his considered opinions on the question. "I hope you'll come, doctor. The subject will interest you." A high wind was blowing on the day Father Vanloo preached his second sermon. The congregation, it must be admitted, was sparser than on the first occasion, partly because this kind of performance had lost its novelty for our townsfolk. Indeed, considering the abnormal conditions they were up against, the very word novelty had lost all meaning. Moreover, most people, assuming they had not altogether abandoned religious observances, or did not combine them naively with a thoroughly immoral way of living, had replaced normal religious practice by more or less extravagant superstitions. Thus they were readier to wear prophylactic medals of St. Roque than to go to Mass. An illustration may be found in the remarkable interest shown in prophecies of all descriptions. True, in the spring, when the epidemic was expected to end abruptly at any moment, no one troubled to take another's opinion as to its probable duration, since everyone had persuaded himself that it would have none. But as the days went by, a fear grew up that the calamity might last indefinitely, and then the ending of the plague became the target of all hopes. As a result, copies of predictions attributed to soothsayers or saints of the Catholic Church circulated freely from hand to hand. The local printing firms were quick to realize the profit to be made by pandering to this new craze and printed large numbers of the prophecies that had been going round in manuscript. Finding that the public appetite for this type of literature was still unsated, they had researches made in the municipal libraries for all the mental pabulum of the kind available in old chronicles, memoirs, and the like. And when this source ran dry, they commissioned journalists to write up forecasts. And, in this respect at least, the journalists proved themselves equal to their prototypes of earlier ages. Some of these prophetic writings were actually serialized in our newspapers, and read with as much avidity as the love stories that had occupied these columns in the piping times of health. Some predictions were based on far-fetched arithmetical calculations involving the figures of the year, the total of deaths, and the number of months the plague had so far lasted. Others made comparisons with the great pestilences of former times, drew parallels, which the forecasters called constants, and claimed to deduce conclusions bearing on the present calamity. But our most popular prophets were undoubtedly those who, in an apocalyptic jargon, had announced sequences of events, any one of which might be construed as applicable to the present state of affairs and was abstruse enough to admit of almost any interpretation. Thus, Nostradamus and St. Odilia were consulted daily, and always with happy results. Indeed, the one thing these prophecies had in common was that, ultimately, all were reassuring. Unfortunately, though, the plague was not. Thus, superstition had usurped the place of religion in the life of our town, and that is why the church in which Vanloo preached his sermon was only three-quarters full. That evening, when Rieu arrived, the wind was pouring in great gusts through the swing doors and filling the aisles with sudden draughts, and it was in a cold, silent church, surrounded by a congregation of men exclusively, that Rieu watched the father climb into the pulpit. He spoke in a gentler, more thoughtful tone than on the previous occasion, and several times was noticed to be stumbling over his words. A yet more noteworthy change was that instead of saying "you," he now said "we." However, his voice grew gradually firmer as he proceeded. He started by recalling that for many a long month plague had been in our midst, and we now knew it better after having seen it often seated at our tables or at the bedsides of those we loved. We had seen it walking by our side or waiting for our coming at the places where we worked. Thus we were now perhaps better able to comprehend what it was telling us unceasingly, a message to which, in the first shock of the visitation, we might not have listened with due heed. What he, Father Panlu, had said in his first sermon still held good. Such, anyhow, was his belief. And yet, perhaps, as may befall any one of us, here he struck his breast, his words and thoughts had lacked in charity. However this might be, one thing was not to be gainsaid, a fact that always, under all circumstances, we should bear in mind. Appearances notwithstanding, all trials, however cruel, work together for good to the Christian. And indeed, what a Christian should always seek in his hour of trial was to discern that good, in what it consisted, and how best he could turn it to account. At this stage, the people near Rieux seemed to settle in against the armrests of their pews and make themselves as comfortable as they could. One of the big padded entrance doors was softly thudding in the wind, and someone got up to secure it. As a result, Rieux's attention wandered, and he did not follow well what Panlu now went on to say. Apparently it came to this. We might try to explain the phenomenon of the plague, but above all should learn what it had to teach us. Rieux gathered that, to the father's thinking, there was really nothing to explain. His interest quickened when, in a more emphatic tone, the preacher said that there were some things we could grasp as touching God, and others we could not. There was no doubt as to the existence of good and evil, and as a rule it was easy to see the difference between them. The difficulty began when we looked into the nature of evil, and among things evil he included human suffering. Thus, we had apparently needful pain and apparently needless pain. We had Don Juan cast into hell and a child's death. For while it is right that a libertine should be struck down, we see no reason for a child's suffering. And, truth to tell, nothing was more important on earth than a child's suffering, the horror it inspires in us, and the reasons we must find to account for it. In other manifestations of life, God made things easy for us, and thus far our religion had no merit. But in this respect, he put us, so to speak, with our backs to the wall. Indeed, we all were up against the wall that plague had built around us, and in its lethal shadow we must work out our salvation. He, Father Panlu, refused to have recourse to simple devices enabling him to scale that wall. Thus, he might easily have assured them that the child's sufferings would be compensated for by an eternity of bliss awaiting him. But how could he give that assurance when, to tell the truth, he knew nothing about it? For who would dare to assert that eternal happiness can compensate for a single moment's human suffering? He who asserted that would not be a true Christian, a follower of the Master who knew all the pangs of suffering in his body and his soul. No, he, Father Panlu, would keep faith with that great symbol of all suffering, the tortured body on the cross. He would stand fast, his back to the wall, and face honestly the terrible problem of a child's agony. And he would boldly say to those who listen to his words today, "My brothers, a time of testing has come for us all. We must believe everything or deny everything. And who among you, I ask, would dare to deny everything?" It crossed Rieux's mind that Father Panlu was dallying with heresy in his sermon, but he had no time to follow up the thought. The preacher was declaring vehemently that this uncompromising duty laid on the Christian was at once his ruling virtue and his privilege. He was well aware that certain minds, schooled to a more indulgent and conventional morality, might well be dismayed, not to say outraged, by the seemingly excessive standard of Christian virtue about which he was going to speak. But religion in a time of plague could not be the religion of every day. While God might accept and even desire that the soul should take its ease and rejoice in happier times, in periods of extreme calamity he laid extreme demands on it. Thus today God had vouchsafed to his creatures an ordeal such that they must acquire and practice the greatest of all virtues, that of the all or nothing. Many centuries previously, a profane writer had claimed to reveal a secret of the Church by declaring that purgatory did not exist. He wished to convey that there could be no half measures. There was only the alternative between heaven and hell. You were either saved or damned. That, according to Panlu, was a heresy that could spring only from a blind, disordered soul. Nevertheless, there may well have been periods of history when purgatory could not be hoped for. Periods when it was impossible to speak of venial sin. Every sin was deadly, and any indifference, criminal. It was all, or it was nothing. The preacher paused, and Rieux heard more clearly the whistling of the wind outside. Judging by the sounds that came in below the closed doors, it had risen to storm pitch. Then he heard Father Panlou's voice again. He was saying that the total acceptance of which he had been speaking was not to be taken in the limited sense usually given to the words. He was not thinking of mere resignation, or even that harder virtue, humility. It involved humiliation, but a humiliation to which the person humiliated gave full assent. True, the agony of a child was humiliating to the heart and to the mind, but that was why we had to come to terms with it. And that too was why, and here Panlou assured those present that it was not easy to say what he was about to say, since it was God's will, we too should will it. Thus, and only thus, the Christian could face the problem squarely, and, scorning subterfuge, pierce to the heart of the supreme issue, the essential choice. And his choice would be to believe everything, so as not to be forced into denying everything. Like those worthy women who, after learning that buboes were the natural issues through which the body cast out infection, went to church and prayed, "Please God, give him buboes," thus the Christian should yield himself wholly to the divine will, even though it passed his understanding. It was wrong to say, "This I understand, but that I cannot accept." We must go straight to the heart of that which is unacceptable, precisely because it is thus that we are constrained to make our choice. The sufferings of children were our bread of affliction, but without this bread, our souls would die of spiritual hunger. The shuffling sounds, which usually followed the moment when the preacher paused, were beginning to make themselves heard when unexpectedly he raised his voice, making as if to put himself in his hearer's place, and ask what then was the proper course to follow. He made no doubt that the ugly word fatalism would be applied to what he said. Well, he would not bother at the word, provided he were allowed to qualify it with the adjective active. Needless to say, there was no question of imitating the Abyssinian Christians of whom he had spoken previously. Nor should one even think of acting like those Persians who in time of plague threw their infected garments on the Christian sanitary workers and loudly called on heaven to give the plague to these infidels who were trying to avert a pestilence sent by God. But on the other hand, it would be no less wrong to imitate the monks at Cairo, who, when plague was raging in the town, distributed the host with pincers at the mass, so as to avoid contact with wet, warm mouths in which infection might be latent. The plague-stricken Persians and the monks were equally at fault. For the former, a child's agony did not count. With the latter, on the contrary, the natural dread of suffering ranked highest in their conduct. In both cases, the real problem had been shirked. They had closed their ears to God's voice. But, Panlou continued, there were other precedents of which he would now remind them. If the chronicles of the Black Death at Marseille were to be trusted, only 4 of the 81 monks in the Mercy Monastery survived the epidemic. And of these 4, 3 took to flight. Thus far, the chronicler, and it was not his task to tell us more than the bare facts. But when he read that chronicle, Father Panlou had found his thoughts fixed on that monk who stayed on by himself despite the death of his 77 companions, and above all, despite the example of his 3 brothers who had fled. And bringing down his fist on the edge of the pulpit, Father Panlou cried in a ringing voice, "My brothers, each one of us must be the one who stays." There was no question of not taking precautions or failing to comply with the orders wisely promulgated for the public weal in the disorders of a pestilence. Nor should we listen to certain moralists who told us to sink on our knees and give up the struggle. No, we should go forward, groping our way through the darkness, stumbling perhaps at times, and try to do what good lay in our power. As for the rest, we must hold fast, trusting in the divine goodness, even as to the deaths of little children, and not seeking personal respite. At this point, Father Panlou evoked the august figure of Bishop Belzunce during the Marseille plague. He reminded his hearers how, toward the close of the epidemic, the bishop, having done all that had behooved him, shut himself up in his palace behind high walls after laying in a stock of food and drink. With a sudden revulsion of feeling, such as often comes in times of extreme tribulation, the inhabitants of Marseille, who had idolized him hitherto, now turned against him, piled up corpses round his house in order to infect it, and even flung bodies over the walls to make sure of his death. Thus, in a moment of weakness, the bishop had proposed to isolate himself from the outside world, and, lo and behold, corpses rained down on his head. This had a lesson for us all. We must convince ourselves that there is no island of escape in time of plague. No, there was no middle course. we must accept the dilemma and choose either to hate God or to love God. And who would dare to choose to hate him? My brothers, the preacher's tone showed he was nearing the conclusion of his sermon, the love of God is a hard love. It demands total self-surrender, disdain of our human personality. And yet, it alone can reconcile us to suffering and the deaths of children. It alone can justify them, since we cannot understand them. And we can only make God's will ours. That is the hard lesson I would share with you today. That is the faith, cruel in men's eyes and crucial in God's, which we must ever strive to compass. We must aspire beyond ourselves toward that high and fearful vision. And on that lofty plane all will fall into place, all discords be resolved, and truth flash forth from the dark cloud of seeming injustice. Thus, in some churches of the south of France, plague victims have lain sleeping many a century under the flagstones of the chancel, and priests now speak above their tombs. And the divine message they bring to men rises from that charnel to which, nevertheless, children have contributed their share. When Rieu was preparing to leave the church, a violent gust swept up the nave through the half-open doors and buffeted the faces of the departing congregation. It brought with it a smell of rain, a tang of drenched sidewalks, warning them of the weather they would encounter outside. An old priest and a young deacon who were walking immediately in front of Rieu had much difficulty in keeping their headdress from blowing away. But this did not prevent the elder of the two from discussing the sermon they had heard. He paid tribute to the preacher's eloquence, but the boldness of thought Panmou had shown gave him pause. In his opinion, the sermon had displayed more uneasiness than real power, and at Panmou's age, a priest had no business to feel uneasy. The young deacon, his head bowed to protect his face from the wind, replied that he saw much of the father, had followed the evolution of his views, and believed his forthcoming pamphlet would be bolder still. Indeed, it might well be refused the imprimatur. You don't mean to say so. What's the main idea? Asked the old priest. They were now in the cathedral square, and for some moments the roar of the wind made it impossible for the younger man to speak. When there was a slight lull, he said briefly to his companion, that it's illogical for a priest to call in a doctor. Carou, when told by Rieu what Panlou had said, remarked that he'd known a priest who had lost his faith during the war as the result of seeing a young man's face with both eyes destroyed. Panlou is right, Carou continued. When an innocent youth can have his eyes destroyed, a Christian should either lose his faith or consent to have his eyes destroyed. Panlou declines to lose his faith, and he'll go through with it to the end. That's what he meant to say. It may be that this remark of Tarou's throws some light on the regrettable events which followed, in the course of which the priest's conduct seemed inexplicable to his friends. The reader will judge for himself. A few days after the sermon, Panmou had to move out of his rooms. It was a time when many people were obliged to change their residence owing to the new conditions created by the plague. Thus Tarou, when his hotel was requisitioned, had gone to live with Rieu. And now the father had to vacate the lodgings provided for him by his order and stay in the house of a pious old lady who had so far escaped the epidemic. During the process of moving, Panmou had been feeling more run down than ever, mentally as well as physically. And it was this that put him in the bad books of his hostess. One evening, when she was enthusiastically vaunting the merits of St. Odilia's prophecies, the priest betrayed a slight impatience, due probably to fatigue. All his subsequent efforts to bring the good lady round to, anyhow, a state of benevolent neutrality came to nothing. He had made a bad impression, and it went on rankling. So each night on his way to his bedroom, where almost all the furniture was dotted with crochet covers, he had to contemplate the back of his hostess seated in her drawing room and carry away with him a memory of the sour, good-night father she flung at him over her shoulder. It was on one such evening that he felt, like a flood bursting the dikes, the turbulent onrush in his wrists and temples of the fever latent in his blood for several days past. The only available account of what followed comes from the lips of the old lady. Next morning she rose early, as was her wont. After an hour or so, puzzled at not seeing the father leave his room, she brought herself, not without some hesitation, to knock at his door. She found him still in bed after a sleepless night. He had difficulty in breathing and looked more flushed than usual. She had suggested, most politely, as she put it, that a doctor should be called in, but her suggestion had been brushed aside with a curtness that she described as quite unmannerly. So she had no alternative but to leave the room. Later in the morning, the father rang and asked if he could see her. He apologized for his lack of courtesy and assured her that what he was suffering from could not be the plague, as he had none of the symptoms. It was no more than a passing indisposition. The lady replied with dignity that her suggestion had not been prompted by any apprehension of that sort. She took no thought for her personal security, which was in God's hands, but that she felt a certain measure of responsibility for the father's welfare while he was under her roof. When he said nothing, his hostess, wishing, according to her account, to do her duty by him, offered to send for her doctor. Father Panelou told her not to trouble, adding some explanations that seemed to the old lady incoherent, not to say nonsensical. The only thing she gathered, and it was precisely this that appeared to her so incomprehensible, was that the father refused to hear of a doctor's visit because it was against his principles. Her impression was that her guest's mind had been unhinged by fever, and she confined herself to bringing him a cup of tea. Resolutely mindful of the obligations imposed on her by the situation, she visited the invalid regularly every 2 hours. What struck her most about him was his restlessness, which continued throughout the day. He would throw off the blankets, then pull them back, and he kept running his hand over his forehead, which was glistening with sweat. Every now and then he sat up in bed and tried to clear his throat with a thick, grating cough, which sounded almost like retching. At these moments he seemed to be vainly struggling to force up from his lungs a clot of some semi-solid substance that was choking him. After each unavailing effort, he sank back, utterly exhausted, on the pillow. Then he would raise himself again a little and stare straight in front of him with a fixity even more dismaying than the paroxysms which had preceded it. Even now, the old lady was reluctant to annoy her guest by calling in the doctor. After all, it might be no more than an attack of fever, spectacular as were its manifestations. However, in the afternoon, she made another attempt to talk to the priest, but she could get out of him no more than a few rambling phrases. She renewed her proposal to call in the doctor, whereat Panelou sat up and in a stifled voice emphatically declined to see a doctor. Under these circumstances, it seemed best to the old lady to wait till the following morning. If the father's condition showed no more improvement, she would ring up the number announced 10 times daily on the radio by the Ransduck Information Bureau. Still conscious of her obligations, she resolved to visit the invalid from time to time in the course of the night and give him any attention he might need. But after bringing him a decoction of herbal tea, she decided to lie down for a while. Only at daybreak did she wake up, and then she hurried to the priest's room. Father Panelou was lying quite still. His face had lost its deep flush of the previous day and had now a deathly pallor, all the more impressive because the cheeks had kept their fullness. He was gazing up at the bead fringe of a lamp hanging above the bed. When the old lady came in, he turned his head to her. As she quaintly put it, he looked as if he'd been severely thrashed all the night long and more dead than alive. She was greatly struck by the apathy of his voice when, on her asking how he was feeling, he replied that he was in a bad way, he did not need a doctor, and all he wished was to be taken to the hospital so as to comply with the regulations. Panic-stricken, she hurried to the telephone. The year came at noon. After hearing what the old lady had to say, he replied briefly that Panelou was right, but it was probably too late. The father welcomed him with the same air of complete indifference. Rieu examined him and was surprised to find none of the characteristic symptoms of bubonic or pneumonic plague, except congestion and obstruction of the lungs. But his pulse was so weak and his general state so alarming that there was little hope of saving him. "You have none of the specific symptoms of the disease," Rieu told him, "but I admit one can't be sure, and I must isolate you." The father smiled queerly, as if for politeness' sake, but said nothing. Rieu left the room to telephone, then came back and looked at the priest. "I'll stay with you," he said gently. Panelou showed a little more animation, and a sort of warmth came back to his eyes when he looked up at the doctor. Then, speaking with such difficulty that it was impossible to tell if there was sadness in his voice, he said, "Thanks. But priests can have no friends. They have given their all to God." He asked for the crucifix that hung above the head of the bed. When given it, he turned away to gaze at it. At the hospital, Panelou did not utter a word. He submitted passively to the treatment given him, but never let go of the crucifix. However, his case continued doubtful, and Rieu could not feel sure how to diagnose it. For several weeks, indeed, the disease had seemed to make a point of confounding diagnoses. In the case of Panelou, what followed was to show that this uncertainty had no consequence. His temperature rose. Throughout the day, the cough grew louder, racking the enfeebled body. At last, at nightfall, Father Panelou brought up the clot of matter that was choking him. It was red. Even at the height of his fever, Panloo's eyes kept their blank serenity. And when, next morning, he was found dead, his body drooping over the bedside, they betrayed nothing. Against his name, the index card recorded, "Doubtful Case." All Souls' Day that year was very different from what it had been in former years. True, the weather was seasonable. There had been a sudden change, and the great heat had given place to mild autumnal air. As in other years, a cool wind blew all day, and big clouds raced from one horizon to the other, trailing shadows over the houses upon which fell again, when they had passed, the pale gold light of a November sky. The first waterproofs made their appearance. Indeed, one was struck by the number of glossy, rubberized garments to be seen. The reason was that our newspapers had informed us that 200 years previously, during the great pestilences of southern Europe, the doctors wore oiled clothing as a safeguard against infection. The shops had seized this opportunity of unloading their stock of out-of-fashion waterproofs, which their purchasers fondly hoped would guarantee immunity from germs. But these familiar aspects of All Souls' Day could not make us forget that the cemeteries were left unvisited. In previous years, the rather sickly smell of chrysanthemums had filled the streetcars, while long lines of women could be seen making pilgrimage to the places where members of the family were buried to lay flowers on the graves. This was the day when they made amends for the oblivion and dereliction in which their dead had slept for so many a long month. But in the plague year, people no longer wished to be reminded of their dead, because indeed they were thinking all too much about them as it was. There was no more question of revisiting them with a shade of regret and much melancholy. They were no longer the forsaken to whom one day in the year you came to justify yourself. They were intruders whom you would rather forget. This is why the Day of the Dead this year was tacitly but willfully ignored. As Cotin dryly remarked, Tarou noted that the habit of irony was growing on him more and more, each day was for us a Day of the Dead. And in fact, the bale fires of the pestilence were blazing ever more merrily in the crematorium. It is true that the actual number of deaths showed no increase, but it seemed that plague had settled in for good at its most virulent, and it took its daily toll of deaths with the punctual zeal of a good civil servant. Theoretically, and in the view of the authorities, this was a hopeful sign. The fact that the graph, after its long rising curve, had flattened out, seemed to many, Dr. Richard for example, reassuring. "The graph's good today," he would remark, rubbing his hands. To his mind, the disease had reached what he called high water mark. Thereafter, it could but ebb. He gave the credit of this to Dr. Castel's new serum, which indeed had brought off some quite unlooked-for recoveries. While not dissenting, the old doctor reminded him that the future remained uncertain. History proved that epidemics have a way of recrudescing when least expected. The authorities, who had long been desirous of giving a fillip to the morale of the populace, but had so far been prevented by the plague from doing so, now proposed to convene a meeting of the medical corps and ask for an announcement on the subject. Unfortunately, just before the meeting was due to take place, Dr. Richard, too, was carried off by the plague, then precisely at high water mark. The effect of this regrettable event, which, sensational as it was, actually proved nothing, was to make our authorities swing back to pessimism as inconsequently as they'd previously indulged in optimism. As for Castel, he confined himself to preparing his serums with a maximum of care. By this time, no public place or building had escaped conversion into a hospital or quarantine camp, with the exception of the prefect's offices, which were needed for administrative purposes and committee meetings. In a general way, however, owing to the relative stability of the epidemic at this time, Rieu's organizations were still able to cope with the situation. Though working constantly at high pressure, the doctors and their helpers were not forced to contemplate still greater efforts. All they had to do was carry on automatically, so to speak, their all but superhuman task. The pneumonic type of infection, cases of which had already been detected, was now spreading all over the town. One could almost believe that the high winds were kindling and fanning its flames in people's chests. The victims of pneumonic plague succumbed much more quickly after coughing up blood-stained sputum. This new form of the epidemic looked like being more contagious as well as even more fatal. However, the opinions of experts had always been divided on this matter. For greater safety, all sanitary workers wore masks of sterilized muslin. On the face of it, the disease should have extended its ravages. But, the cases of bubonic plague showing a decrease, the death rate remained constant. Meanwhile, the authorities had another cause for anxiety in the difficulty of maintaining the food supply. Profiteers were taking a hand and purveying at enormous prices essential foodstuffs not available in the shops. The result was that poor families were in great straits, while the rich went short of practically nothing. Thus, whereas plague, by its impartial ministrations, should have prompted equality among our townsfolk, it now had the opposite effect, and thanks to the habitual conflict of cupidities, exacerbated the sense of injustice rankling in men's hearts. They were assured, of course, of the inevitable quality of death, but nobody wanted that kind of equality. Poor people who were feeling the pinch thought still more nostalgically of towns and villages in the nearby countryside, where bread was cheap and life without restrictions. Indeed, they had a natural, if illogical, feeling that they should have been permitted to move out to these happier places. The feeling was embodied in a slogan shouted in the streets and chalked up on walls: bread or fresh air. This half-ironical battle cry was the signal for some demonstrations that, though easily repressed, made everyone aware that an ugly mood was developing among us. The newspapers, needless to say, complied with the instructions given them: optimism at all costs. If one was to believe what one read in them, our populace was giving a fine example of courage and composure. But in a town thrown back upon itself, in which nothing could be kept secret, no one had illusions about the example given by the public. To form a correct idea about the courage and composure talked about by our journalists, you had only to visit one of the quarantine depots or isolation camps established by our authorities. As it so happens, the narrator, being fully occupied elsewhere, had no occasion to visit any of them, and must fall back on Tharou's diary for a description of the conditions in these places. Tharou gives an account of a visit he made, accompanied by Rambert, to the isolation camp located in the municipal stadium. The stadium lies on the outskirts of the town, between a street along which runs a car line and a stretch of wasteland extending to the extreme edge of the plateau on which Oran is built. It was already surrounded by high concrete walls, and all that was needed to make escape practically impossible was to post sentries at the four entrance gates. The walls served another purpose. They screened the unfortunates in quarantine from the view of people on the road. Against this advantage may be set the fact that the inmates could hear all day, though they could not see them, the passing streetcars, and recognize by the increased volume of sound coming from the road the hours when people had knocked off work or were going to it. And this brought home to them that the life from which they would be barred was going on as before within a few yards of them, and that those high walls parted two worlds as alien to each other as two different planets.